This podcast was recorded on Friday, August 28th at 10:35 a.m. Things might have changed by the time you hear this.
Yeah, like the suburbs will just completely disappear.
That would be incredible. Unlikely, but incredible.
Sounds like it's what's going to happen.
We'll see. Let's talk Ohio politics. This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics and the shrewd politicians who pander to their bases and hope people in the middle are not paying attention. I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown. Coming up later in the podcast, Ohio has largely reopened. The number of daily COVID-19 cases is coming down, but a handful of lawmakers still want to impeach Governor Mike DeWine.
Incredible. But first, from the stage of the Republican National Convention, also known as the South Lawn of the White House, i.e. the People's House, President Trump made his case for four more years, largely by demonizing his opponent.
If the left gains power, they will demolish the suburbs, confiscate your guns, and appoint justices who will wipe away your Second Amendment and other constitutional freedoms. Biden is a Trojan horse for socialism.
The speech capped the four-day, mostly virtual Republican National Convention. There were some speeches in front of audiences, though, but for the most part, Republicans like Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio spoke virtually, where they predicted mayhem if Americans elect Joe Biden.
Democrats won't let you go to church, but they'll let you protest. Democrats won't let you go to work, but they'll let you riot. And Democrats won't let you go to school, but they'll let you go loot.
Of course, none of that is true. Joe Biden and Democrats do not support looting, rioting, confiscating guns, or keeping people from worshiping, except during a pandemic when packing churches can, you know, kill people.
That's right. So lots to digest from this week. And here to help us is a longtime digester of politics, Ohio State University political scientist and longtime friend of Snollygoster, Paul Beck. Paul, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be with you. And I'm suffering a little bit of indigestion, but by and large,
let's get through it together here. We talked last week in this exact same context, following the Democratic National Convention. When I asked you what you expected from Republicans, you said a darker tone. It seems like they lived up to the hype, right? That was the overall message, that don't elect Democrats if you want to preserve our society, basically.
Well, that's certainly the case. What they needed to do was to demonize Biden and the Democrats as much as possible. And they certainly focused on that both last night in terms of the president's address, but also throughout the week in terms of the addresses of various people who were on the stage at the Republican National Convention.
A re-election campaign, Paul, is always a referendum on the incumbent. As long as if the current conditions are not good, the incumbent is in trouble and tends to lose if the opponent is palatable. Is that what's going to happen here? I mean, Donald Trump seems to be really focusing on demonizing his opponent rather than making the case for why he needs four more years.
Well, I think if the election was a straight up referendum on the president, he would lose. You see this in the approval ratings, which you'll barely get above the mid-40s and may even go lower than that. High disapproval ratings, high percentages of people thinking that the United States is on the wrong track. So there are all those factors that really are commentary on the incumbent administration. What the Trump campaign is trying to do, of course, is to move it away from being a conversation about the president and a referendum on the president, and demonize the opposition, to say, well, okay, if you're not totally satisfied with the president or what the president is doing, you're going to get worse if you were to elect Joe Biden and Kamala Harris as president and vice president. And you saw this coming out four square during this week of Republican convention hearing, and we'll see it for the rest of the campaign, as we did even before this week.
You know, outside of the speech from First Lady Melania Trump, you would not know, really, that we're in the midst of a global pandemic that has cost hundreds of thousands of lives and has sickened millions of people in the U.S. The Republicans essentially seem to be trying to act like that didn't happen. They're trying to take credit for the economy, which, you know, many will say they should. They take credit for the economy pre-pandemic. But they're trying to act like we're basically in March at this point, like we have this wonderful economy and everything is great.
Well, they certainly don't want to talk about the pandemic because the pandemic has played very badly for them, partly through the president's mishandling of the response to the pandemic, partly through just the numbers. You know, it is a true pandemic with very serious consequences. It has undermined the economy. It has cost, 180,000 Americans and still counting their lives. Even if you were to look before the pandemic, when the economy was really the president's strong suit, it was not a great economy. The stock market was doing fine, but in terms of the number of people who were going back to work, that was not so good. Unemployment rates were indeed low, but the president never really lived up to his promises that he would get growth to be higher than it had been during the Obama years. So it you know, was a claim that certainly is made and is going to continue to be made, but it's a claim that I think is hard to make given what's happened between March and now, or March and the election day itself in November.
Of course, another thing that's happened between March and now is the death of George Floyd, the protest, also another death this week in Kenosha, Wisconsin. The racial justice protests, police brutality protests have struck a lot of cities, including here in Ohio, Cleveland, Columbus, Cincinnati, and even some of the suburbs. And that has led to the birth of a law and order campaign by President Trump. What is his strategy? Let's start there. First, what is his strategy and the Republican strategy on this whole law and order campaign?
Well, of course, he's positioning himself as the protector of law and order. And in some ways, that's almost natural. It's a reaction to the kinds of demonstrations that have occurred. There's been some violence associated with them. He's raising the specter of just horrible futures if Biden and Harris are in the White House, and arguing that what you're seeing here in the violence is something that both is perpetrated by the Democrats, which is false, of course, but secondly, a recipe for what's going to happen in future years under a Biden presidency. It's worth adding, by the way, that he is operating almost as if he is not president. These would be accusations that would be far easier to make, as Richard Nixon did in 1968 and afterwards, if he were outside of the White House criticizing the current administration. But these are things that have happened under his watch. He's not necessarily responsible for them, but it's very hard for him to move away from them and move away from this conflagration that has occurred over these police shootings.
I wanted to ask you about that. The 1968 campaign, Richard Nixon ran on law and order. There was tremendous upheaval in 1968. Of course, the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr., Robert Kennedy, protests that followed King's assassination, protests during the Democratic National Convention. This was Richard Nixon's campaign. Democrats have led to this chaos. You need to put me in the White House, put Republicans in power to bring law and order to the country. Times are different. First of all, in 1968, we were in the heat of the Vietnam War. So that was fueling a lot of these protests. We don't have a war like that right now. What else is different? And as you mentioned, Richard Nixon was the challenger or the challenging party and not the incumbent party, not the incumbent president. What else is different or similar between 1968 and now 2020?
Well, I think several things are different. First, the kinds of violence and riots that occurred in the late 1960s were far more dramatic, far more widespread than they are today. These have been relatively contained protests, mostly peaceful. I grew up in Ann Arbor, or was living in Ann Arbor at the time of the Detroit riots. And these were actual riots with a lot of violence taking place, a lot of burning of property, a lot of shootings taking place. We don't see anything like that today, even if the Republicans are trying to kind of stoke the fires and build this into something that is really major. So that's one thing. Secondly, I think the country has changed. There's much more tolerance today than there was back then. You don't have a situation in the South, for instance, that you did then when there was a candidate, George Wallace, we forget about him in 1968, but he was able to secure 13-14% of the vote in that election. Richard Nixon barely wins the election. Had Hubert Humphrey been able to garner a few hundred thousand more votes, he would have been president. So very different situation there. And of course, the major thing is that it was very easy for Nixon to blame the incumbent administration, the Johnson administration, and of course Humphrey was its vice president. Very easy for him to blame them for what was going on. Today, he's not going to blame himself for what is going on. He's blaming, of course, the mayors of these, as he puts it, Democratic cities. That, I think, is going to be much less effective and has been less effective than would have been the case back in the 1960s.
Paul, do you think this is a winning strategy, this law and order campaign? As you say, times have changed. People are more tolerant now, but Trump still has a very dedicated base. There are still a lot of people who so-called back the blue. There are a lot of people who say Blue Lives Matter. He has a very vocal, very strong base. He won an election 4 years ago. Do you think this is a winning strategy for him in 2020?
Well, the fair answer is I don't know. We'll see. My thinking about it, and you know, going back to the Republican convention this week, it'll be interesting to see what the audience figures are like. The Democratic convention audience was smaller than it had been 4 years before, but of course the media has changed in those 4 years. A lot more people follow the convention, or at least parts of it, on the web, and that can't really be picked up in the ratings that we see. But anyway, what the Republicans are doing is trying to mobilize their own base. If that's all they're able to do, they can't win the election. That base is too small. If, on the other hand, they are able to pull away from an undecided posture, a large number of voters, even create some erosion in the base on the Democratic side, then maybe they can pull it off. It's going to be an uphill struggle. The convention, by the way, I thought both parties ran a pretty good convention, doing the kinds of things they wanted to do. The Republican production last week was a very slick production. Fact checkers are going wild, of course, because there was all kinds of exaggeration and falsehood there. But what they're trying to do is build a narrative, of course, that is going to be successful for them in the fall campaign.
Is there any chance, Paul, that this convention was designed to suppress the vote on the Democratic side, not legally suppress them, I mean, not illegally, you know, as far as putting up barriers and things like that, but just, you know, decrease enthusiasm for Joe Biden? Let's face it, one of the prime reasons why Donald Trump is president is because a lot of people did not like Hillary Clinton. Is he just trying to raise the dislikability of Joe Biden and thus prompt folks to just stay home who might vote for him, and that allows his very passionate base? God, I was up in northern Michigan and northern Wisconsin, rural areas, very, very rural areas, very conservative swing states, and there were signs everywhere. So his base is still fired up and will come out to vote. By demonizing Democrats and Joe Biden, is he basically trying to lessen the enthusiasm for Biden?
Well, of course he is. What you hope to do is discourage people, make them think that, well, okay, I don't like Trump. On the other hand, Biden isn't so great either, and there are going to be problems if Biden is elected as president. And so given that, I think I'm just not going to vote, or at least not be as enthusiastic a voter as I might have otherwise been. There's another thing as well, and you saw this last night, but you've seen it on earlier nights. And that is that there was an attempt at the Republican convention to humanize President Trump. He's been attacked as somebody who lacked empathy. There was an emphasis during the convention on how empathetic he is, at least in a personal kind of way. I'm not sure that's going to work very well, because you have 4 years of Trump behavior that if people are paying any attention to, they're going to see as not really showing a humane and empathetic figure. But the attempt was there anyway. And then to talk about Biden's empathy as a weakness rather than a strength. So yeah, there are attempts, of course, to attack Biden, to undermine his campaign, to undermine his standing, in the hopes that they can maybe appeal to voters beyond this Republican base, as well as firing up the base. And they do need to fire up the base. But as I said before, that's not going to be enough to be able to secure the election. When you're mired in the approval ratings in the low 40s, and the disapproval ratings are in the mid 50s, as they have been for a long, long time, you're not going to be able to win re-election.
Paul Beck, political digester. You don't have an indigestion. You sound great.
Thank you.
Have some Tums for breakfast.
Yeah. Anyway, Paul Beck, Ohio State political scientist.
You know,
go ahead, Paul. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to add one other thing that I just thought of, and that is, and you saw this trumpeted during the entire Republican campaign, is that they're the party, he is the candidate who is going to protect your liberty. Your liberty not to wear a mask, your liberty to send your kids back to school, your liberty to practice your religion by congregating in churches, these kinds of things. I think that will be a pitch that will resonate with a lot of people. And it's kind of an interesting twist on things where they're defending civil liberties and the Bill of Rights, in a sense, also the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, and positioning themselves as the protectors of liberty against these Democrats who will take away your liberty, force you to wear masks, force you to stay at home, and so forth. Whether that's going to work, it flies in the face of what the public is telling us, that by and large, most Americans are in favor of wearing masks when they go out. They are very skeptical about starting up schools too soon. They're very worried about the pandemic itself, and willing to take some measures, and these are hardly earth-shaking measures, to try to contain the pandemic as much as they can.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a bit of a stretch, but I think we'll see if it works. I think they're trying to just dampen enthusiasm for Joe Biden and hope to do the same as they did in 2016, and they may succeed. The Republicans may. It worked once. Why not try it again? Paul Beck, OSU political scientist.
Well, what they have going against them is that Biden is not as unpopular as Hillary Clinton was, and the Democrats are going to be, one thinks, better prepared this time than they were back in 2016.
Indeed. Paul Beck, OSU political scientist. Thanks for joining us here on Snollygoster.
We'll be right back.
Is there something you've always wondered about Columbus? Like,
how did Circleville get its name?
Does Columbus have an accent?
How much has the NRA donated to Ohio lawmakers?
What happened to passenger rail in Columbus?
Curious Seabus is WOSU series that investigates questions submitted by you, our listeners. What have you always wondered about Columbus? Submit a question you're curious about today at WOSU.org/curious.
Welcome back to Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media. We have another impeachment movement. How exciting.
Indeed.
What a year. The movement may be a little strong, more like an impeachment twitch or an impeachment little reflex, I guess.
Yeah, twitch is a good word. It's a twitch from a handful, a small handful, of far, far right Republican state reps. Four members of the Ohio House have filed articles of impeachment against Governor DeWine. Representatives John Becker, Candace Keller, Nino Vitale, and Paul Zeltwanger say DeWine should be removed from office because of his stay-at-home orders during the COVID pandemic.
DeWine says he's trying to save lives and keep the economy going, and based on the big grin on his face when he was asked about it, he really doesn't seem too concerned.
If there are others in the legislature who want to spend their time on drawing up resolutions and filing articles, look, it's a free country. If that's how they want to spend their time, I would just say to them, have at it.
Have at it.
Have at it. Yeah. Nino Vitale, no surprise that he's involved. He's been the biggest critic of DeWine during this whole situation. He's been posting all kinds of, honestly, nonsense on Facebook, calling the governor dictator DeWine. Ohio's largely reopened. Our case numbers are going down now that everyone is wearing masks.
Yeah, I don't.
Or most people are wearing masks.
Not really
Nino Vitale.
I don't understand this. It's
all just to appease their base.
It truly is a stunt. It's not even appeasing their base.
They're just saying they did it.
It's a stunt, and we're talking about it. They're getting headlines, and
it's the first time it's happened in more than a century. that there have been articles of impeachment filed against the sitting governor.
I mean, four members out of 99 favor this. There's no indication that any of the other...
No leader on either side.
95 lawmakers in the House favor this. Certainly not going to go anywhere in the Senate. It's just a stunt. And but, you know, on the other hand, GOP lawmakers, this is when Larry Householder was the speaker, did pass some restrictions on DeWine's authority, which he vetoed and didn't go anywhere in the Senate.
Trying to limit the power of his public health orders.
Yeah, so they didn't go anywhere. But the House did approve it. The majority of House members approved some limits on his authority. So there's some movement for that, but getting rid of him? The man has a 75% approval rating.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there's no will to do it, and it won't happen. And anyway, speaking of political posturing, time now for our Snollygoster of the Week Award. And this one is a doozy. She's not from Ohio. We don't even know if she's ever been to Ohio. But her performance was so performative. She stole the show at the Republican convention and steals our Snollygoster of the Week Award.
Ladies and gentlemen, leaders and fighters for freedom and liberty and the American dream, the best is yet to come.
How great is that? If you haven't been paying attention, that's Kimberly Guilfoyle. She's a former Fox News commentator, girlfriend of Donald Trump Jr., and advisor to the president.
And, those roles may not be in also, particular order of importance anyway.
She's very talented at shouting at empty rooms.
That was a strange speech.
We didn't even include...
I wouldn't even call it a speech.
We didn't even include her talking... She was portraying as California as this hellscape riddled with heroin needles and riots and rolling blackouts. That was something else.
Yep.
This is the first time I've ever seen you speechless, Mike.
There really is not much to say, but it was shrewd. I guess. Would you call it shrewd? Yes, you have to call
certainly
it shrewd.
Opportunistic. I would. Yes. I mean, it was very... There's a large segment of our country that feels that way. Maybe not large, but they're there. But
that's not who they need to attract. That's not who they need to attract to vote for President Trump.
That wasn't they're already that was not an appeal to moderate suburban soccer moms and dads.
Yeah. It was a great kickoff from a red meat standpoint.
Yeah, we've said that a lot this week.
Conservative perspective is a great kickoff to the convention. And it also, let's face it, the internet went crazy.
Great memes.
Late night comics went crazy. So she does deserve our Snollygoster of the Week. Kimberly Guilfoyle.
Congrats to you, Kimberly Guilfoyle. That will do it for this week. If you have a suggestion for next week's Snollygoster of the Week Award, you can send it to snollygoster@wosu.org. As always, thanks to our audio engineer, Eric French, our student producer, Jack Long, and our web producer, Michael DeBonis. Until next week, I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Mike Thompson for Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media.